doing? Daniel Ruiz Tyson is available for Monday the 6th of February 2017 with me, Daniel Ruiz Tyson, episode 166. I hope you're all well, keeping on doing what you need to be doing to keep yourself going. Vocal tract exercises, tick. Herbal deep heat applied to back, shoulder and neck, tick. Blue tack on microphone tripod, tick. Vicks smeared under the nostrils, tick. Vicks nasal inhaler on standby, tick. Peppermint tea, tick. Tiger balm on temples, tick. Standby battery for mic, tick. Next door mosquito coast, hippie neighbour not doing any hippie good life type activity next door, tick. We are all good to go, and it's a show this week every bit as packed as the best kebabs. Good opening, David. Impressive. Build on it now. Build on it. A long week in Lambeth, southwest London. Cold and wet, warmer towards the end of the week. I don't have to have the heating on in this room this week. There were even moments on particular days where it got warm enough for me to remove two of my four tops as I worked away. I began the week with a curious, very intense craving for a chocolate eclair. I'm not a big sweets fan or whatever it is you call them. I've probably had no more than 20 eclairs in my life, I think, owing to that decade-long aversion to milk as a kid, which meant that attempts to light cakes with piped cream and things like Angel Delight were never successful. And for some reason, I really wanted to like these things. I always liked the idea of liking biscuity type things with piped cream in the middle. I was obsessed with liking those things. So I would suppose my inability to embrace such things earlier in my life would explain why my eclair stats are so low. I don't know why over the last few weeks I've wanted the eclair so bad. I eventually got one from Sainsbury's on Wednesday afternoon. I posted a picture of the eclair. You might notice my pronunciation of the eclair. Eclair is inconsistent too, like that last word I was inconsistent on at urinal. In this case, I would suggest that it's because the eclair has never been a consistent feature in my life. But I tweeted this picture on Wednesday afternoon, posted it also on the Facebook page, a picture of the eclair, a terrible glass of instant coffee, and my copy of the latest Mature Times 2. This was seen on the Facebook page by our French friend, Monsieur Bucket, who posted, "So you got your eclair." I certainly did. Minor grumbles. I felt the chocolate was a little too dark. I'm not a dark chocolate fan. I think I can just about get on with it in a Jaffa cake, but I've never really been one for dark chocolate. I think the eclair definitely helped my week. I just had to do it. I skipped lunch, so I didn't have any post-gluttony guilt. The eclair is out of the way now, I'm pleased to report. I finally got around to that second-hand banana Yoshimoto novella I got just after Christmas. Hard-boiled, hard luck. Heavy curry-like stains on the upper edges, the outer borders of pages 36 to 37. Heavy on the hand-gelling and hand-washing after handling the book. Friday, 3rd of February, on my way to the cafe at approximately 10:46 hours, more of which later. I boarded my bus successfully, and I was pleased that I'd ascended to the upper deck before the bus began moving away from the stop, which meant I didn't have to touch any handrails. A good job too, bearing in mind what was to unfold. I was back on the Banana Yoshimoto book with its children's transfer stickers on page 50, and the stickers left me guessing what words were underneath. And I reached this particular paragraph on page 50. Now I'm wondering, maybe that paragraph carried crucial book information that's played a part in my not quite enjoying the book. I was already, I think, struggling with the book owing to the disappointing state it had arrived in. I had the aforementioned curry stains as well 15 pages earlier. The stickers just added to that. I knew the stickers were there in advance of beginning the book because I'd flicked through the book when it had arrived. And I just wasn't happy about the state of the book, which is why it's taken me a while to get to it. And also, I've been reading a few other things on my Kindle. This is a paperback, though. And then as I was about to get off my bus, I reached for my hand gel, only it wasn't there. I'd swapped bags since Wednesday, switched into a smaller bag as I wasn't taking my laptop with me to the cafe. The laptop had been playing up since its Wednesday out into the cafe. Still no resolution there with the laptop issues. Seeing I'd forgotten the hand gel, I thought to myself, this is going to test me. This is going to be a very difficult moment for me. I was all over the place. It was a long walk to the cafe. I kept my hands at my side, out of my pocket. They hung at my sides, my arms, as limp as a cold January erection when the last of the Economy 7 heating has left the flat. Hey, Thursday night, I tweeted a link to a brilliant documentary I found on the iPlayer. It's about 10 years old. It's about the Villa Road squatters in Brixton, SW9, which is about 10-15 minutes from where I grew up in Clapham North. And growing up in Lambeth in the late 70s, the area had lots of bomb-damaged sites, and it had lots of squatters. And the squatters particularly is what stays in the memory with me. House after house with sheets of corrugated iron. It's a memory that never leaves me. It was so grim and grey growing up in that borough. We had squatters on our road at St. Mary's, St. Alphonsus Road. One of the guys ended up working with my dad. I've mentioned that story before. This was an Italian guy. He used to have a guitar. He used to play in some of the pubs in Stockwell in the sort of mid-80s. I was in assembly at St. Mary's. I think we used to have an assembly pretty much every day. It was in the new dinner centre. Nelly might remember this. He might not. And the new dinner centre, which also doubled up as our gym, faced the squats on St. Alphonsus Road. This is just off Clapham Park Road in SW4, southwest London. And I remember looking out, and I don't know if Nelly saw this. It's something that I've never forgotten. I was looking out. Someone was knocking on this particular door, and a floor up, this guy opened the sash window and he was completely naked. And a few months later, he was working alongside my dad in a house on Mayflower Road. I was about 11 years old that summer. The kid whose dad's house was being done was about 7 or 8. I told that kid, I've seen that guy naked, and I explained where I'd seen the guy naked, and the kid told the guy, and it made things very difficult for my dad, who was not very impressed at the fact I'd not been able to keep my mouth shut. That's the story there. By the mid-70s, Lambeth had around 5,000 squatters, which was more than any other London borough. And my mum would always walk through Villa Road when she was taking myself and my younger sibling with her on our way to Spanish Carnoos, who lived on the Angel Town estate. And to find this documentary specifically on a road that I remember so vividly, a road I remember, I'm not sure if uncomfortable is the right word. It's a road that I didn't quite like, just simply because of the state of it. And I never liked that walk to Angel Town. And we would, over the years, vary the roads that we took to Angel Town because it wasn't a great journey there. You know, it was bad enough that the estate was so rough. And, you know, we'd always find a different route once on the estate. The walkways were taken off the estate. There were walkways that linked up the various buildings on the estate. They were taken away, I think, at some point in the mid-80s because there were so many robberies on the estate, and the idea was to make it difficult for the robbers to escape from the estate. The problem was that pushed residents into having to go up to their flats via the back of Angel Town, you know, through the very dimly lit hallways. So if anything, it made it more difficult for people living on the estate. So any journey to Angel Town was fraught and uncomfortable. And Villa Road became the favoured route, I suppose, in time. It became the route that we would take probably for the last 13, 14 years of visiting my aunt on the estate. And the houses always looked distinctive. You know, they looked squalid, yet interesting at the same time. They were big houses. And at the residence, whenever you saw them, they looked like something out of Dexy's Midnight Runners. And I can't recommend this documentary enough. It's a very interesting hour. It shows the battle that the squatters had with Lambeth Council. Lambeth Council were trying to demolish those houses. What it never covered, and which I've not been able to find any information on, was why the houses were derelict in the first place. Why were so many houses in London actually of that period derelict? That's something I personally don't know. In the end, a compromise was reached with the squatters whereby the north side of the road would be saved and the south side would be demolished. This was to make way for a new green space, which opened in 78. And years later, this little park would be renamed Max Roach Park. I think Max Roach was some jazz musician. I'm not 100% sure on that, but I think he was. I remember that park being built. I remember the space around that, what became that park, was boarded up for ages. I actually remember Stockwell Skateboard Park being built too, which to me was never Stockwell. That to me was Brixton, so I don't know why it was always called Stockwell Skate Park. I've never used that skate park. I've used Max Roach Park a lot, though not for about 25 years almost now. In the mid to late 80s, by the way, all you saw at the skate park was BMX bikes. The skateboard from the mid 80s onwards suffered a really dramatic fall from grace, and it was probably the early 90s before the skateboard was really seen again more than bikes in the skateboard park. Back to Villa Road, at the bottom of Villa Road, opposite St. John's, the Evangelist Church, I think that's called Peckford Place, the corner of Villa Road, I remember someone painting a giant mural on the corner of a house there. Personally, I've never liked murals, and murals even now are a big part of Lambeth. I don't know what it was about them. I just know that I never liked them, even as a boy. I didn't like that kind of art. I mean, I've documented before on this show that art is not really my thing. But murals especially bother me. I remember walking through Battersea, an estate in Battersea in 96. Now, I think this is Wandsworth, actually, rather than Lambeth. But it was about 4 in the morning, and a bunch of us, including the Space Daddy, were making our way back into Lambeth from a party in the area, and there was a mural on the estate, this Battersea estate, and one of the guys that was with us looked at the mural and scoffed, "Yes, that'll stop the violence." I think it was the thinking behind the murals as much as the art that bothered me about murals. But just the general look of the artwork. Lots of flowers, the sun, plants, a whole kind of Garden of Eden type look. I think that's why there's never been any danger of me getting a tattoo. They look too much like murals, especially when they start fading. And as I've just said, I'm more about words rather than pictures. Also, I have a theory on tattoos and their rise. All the decorative flora that you see in so much of the ink so prevalent in our society now, I wonder if that is in some way related to our shrinking accommodation, especially among the indigenous population that have piled into London from the sticks, who've grown up in houses, who might have had gardens, and they come here to London where accommodation is so shocking. They're moving into tiny flats. They miss their gardens. So they get a load of flora inked up on their skin to try and fill that gap in their lives. It's just a theory, but not one I think that can be dismissed right away. I never had a garden. I never wanted a garden. I don't need to doodle flora on my body. It always worried me with Mayflower Road, 48 Mayflower Road, being the last house on that street and being on a corner, that I would wake up one morning to find a giant mural on the side of our house. As it was, thankfully, the worst we got was some graffiti alluding to how many years my dad had spent at night school. I think it said 21 years, which was, of course, incorrect. If you're a long-time listener, you'll know my dad did 18 straight years at our local college. ¶¶ You're listening to Daniel Ruiz Tyson is Available, episode 166 for Monday the 6th of February 2017. January is now behind us. This is the other side of the midlife crisis, which really, in my own experience, just means another midlife crisis. It is ongoing. Ways, as always, to get in touch. Twitter at 1607 WestEgg. DRT available at westegg1607.co.uk. Facebook.com/ Daniel Ruiz Tyson. If you're not already following that page, then why not join it? I'll admit, I've never quite gotten how to use Facebook properly. It's not my thing. I've posted more on there recently, trying to make an effort with the show's page. I've posted on themes that crop up often on this show, such as housing, rather than just always linking to the show. But bizarrely, in posting, I'm losing loads of followers or likes, whatever it is on there. Maybe people just see the page come up on their timeline and think, who is this? Why am I following this guy? Most of them came to the page back in my long ago stand-up days and have probably forgotten who I was and are just wondering, well, why did we follow this guy in the first place? But if you haven't joined, if you'd like to join, please feel free. Do please also, if you're enjoying the podcast and if you download it by iTunes or have access to iTunes, do leave a rating and review on there. We are nowhere near the charts. Small shows like this need our reviews, and it's not enough just to rate it. It needs the review too. Just a line or two. I'd be happy with that. Do be aware too that if you're listening on any other platform that offers the opportunity to give ratings and reviews, for example, as I said last week, I know Stitcher offer that option. Do please take that time to help raise the show's profile. Some admin now. Last week we had the debut of the Not So Secret Diary of the Kid Aged 29 and a Half, in which, and it was news to me, my older de facto still living at home manager revealed he'd bought a new car. The old forest green car was no more. I got in touch with a kid to see if I could get more details on the new wheels. The new car is a black BMW 3 Series Coupe 58 plate, said the kid. What does that even mean? It's a lovely car, continued our young friend, and it's the only car I wanted, hence the delay in getting it and holding onto the Green Ranger for so long. The Green Machine, aka the Green Lantern, aka the Green Goblin, was sold to my mechanic, who is going to repair it and sell on. He knows it's a great car. There were many exploits in that car, Daniel, more often than not late at night in supermarket car parks, but I don't think they can be shared on the podcast. I'm hoping to have another week-long diary entry from the kid soon. Continuing the housekeeping, questions from Neil via his wife Geraldine, following on from last week's. Nelly, remember this, an item revolving around my childhood friendship with Nelly. Neil wanted to know if I ever got the moped that I mentioned on last week's episode 165. The answer is no. I knew by the time I was in my late teens that I was just simply too clumsy and lacked the road sense to be on the road. I think I knew that as far back as the grifter year, that intense road training with my dad when he bought me that big, heavy royal blue grifter and took me out every night. I'm a child of the 70s. One of the first big shows that I remember was Man About the House, the Thames television sitcom of the mid-70s. Well, I think it was from 73 to 76, starring Richard O'Sullivan. And of course, out of that series, there was the spin-off George and Mildred, which, if anything, was even more successful. And I can't watch George and Mildred, the movie, which came out in 1980, I think around the time Euta Joyce, who played Mildred, died tragically young. She had a serious alcohol problem. I can't watch that film without being reminded of The Grifter, because I think that film was shown on ITV either Christmas Day 1980 or Boxing Day 1980. And just after it started, my dad made me go out with him on The Grifter to make my Grifter debut. And every day after that, every night after school, he took me out on that bike against my will. It took me 4 months to learn how to ride that thing. And after that, I didn't want to know. There was nowhere I couldn't get to by bus or tube. when you've got your dad running alongside you as you cycle, and he's topless, and he's wearing tight blue retro shorts, any love you have for cycling, any love which may be possible for cycling, of which mine was admittedly small, it just dies right away. And, you know, the Grefter story was, of course, covered on an advent calendar episode. Secondly, Neil wanted to know if the San Marco pizza place on Clapham High Street opposite his old Nelson's Row home was still there. I can't be sure, but some quick Googling suggested to me that it is still there. I remember the pizza shops descending on Clapham in the late 80s. Being a fat kid from 84 to 88, as documented on previous podcasts, I needed no encouragement to frequent those pizza shops. I'd be getting pizza and that weird garlic bread from, I think it was Domino's or was it Perfect Pizza for lunch, often with Neil. It was all new. Then I'd have dinner in the evening. I was having two meals a day. Jackets, the old Jacket Potato place on Clapham High Street. I feel that I missed out by not going there, and I walked past it hundreds of times. There was also one, I think, in Brixton. They were there for about 20 years before they disappeared. It's a source of regret that I never got a baked potato, much like the Savaloy. The Savaloy, you know, while easy to eat on the move, visually didn't look good as a takeaway. The baked potato didn't really suffer from that poor visual. But the difficulty with the baked potato, with eating it on the move, when you factor in the amount of slicing, you know, if you think about eating a baked potato at home and how often you're having to cut into it, and it's a, you know, it's a knife and fork meal, I think it was inevitable that the baked potato was on borrowed time, especially once South London's obsession with fried chicken grew from the early noughties onwards. It was Neil's birthday yesterday, by the way, and I'd like to take this opportunity to wish my old friend a happy birthday. We'll have some more Nelly Remember This soon. I think even my memory is starting to fade now. One of the things about doing these Nelly pieces for me, one of the interesting things, is it's made me remember little things that I'd forgotten because we haven't been in each other's lives for 25 years now. And for instance, I've been remembering what a great laugh Neil had. It was a kind of croaky laugh. It was kind of like kind of like that. And I wonder if that's still the case. And he laughed a lot, and I'd forgotten how much Nelly laughed. And that's been nice for me to recall that. On a more serious note, if you want to know more about Neil's situation, I have tweeted links and posted them too on the Facebook page. Neil has been diagnosed now for several years with multiple sclerosis, primary progressive MS, for which there is no treatment here in the UK. Now, all the details of Neil's situation can be found on those links. If you can RT and share them, I'd be grateful. If you don't do Twitter, if you don't do Facebook, firstly, I'd like to genuinely congratulate you for having an old school social media free life. That is brilliant. If you do listen to this show, though, and if you'd like to find out more about Neil, the link to Neil's story is gofundme.com/getneilwalking. Now, on there, there is a breakdown of how Neil might just be able to walk again. Thank you, everyone who has already shared and retweeted that link on social media. It is appreciated. The Neil that you'll be reading about on that page is not the Neil that I knew. I can grumble about our friendship being truncated rather prematurely in the early 90s, but this is something that his family are dealing with. It's about Neil. It's about them. It's nothing to do with me. I'm learning as I go along about his situation and trying to understand where Neil is now in his life and what kind of person he was as he began his life with his partner, and what kind of father he is and has been, what he had in his life, what might be missing in his life. from now on, at the same time trying to recall the Nelly that I knew, the fun guy who enjoyed his life, a family man, a leader of the St. Mary's Rebels team in 82-83, of course, up against Spud Murphy, let's not forget, who was creaming off all the best players for his Galacticos team in the fourth year. It's about trying to do anything that this show might be able to do to highlight his situation. And if I can, and if I can do that, I will do it. I've been building up my hours writing over the last week now that I'm just a few weeks away from making a full recovery. Last week I was working from 8 a.m. to about 3 p.m. This week though I upped that by an hour. I was working until 4 and then I had a couple of days working through to about 5 o'clock, 5:30, which is my normal day. It was a tougher writing week on that second draft of the TV script. It always is when you're typing up the changes and just trying to be a bit ruthless and trying to cut into the superfluous stuff. I'm not sure I've quite done that yet. Maybe this week the confidence has taken a little dent. I don't know. I'll pick it up next week and I will push on with it. Thursday I worked my behind off on the script. I ended up having to neck a couple of Nurofen, laying off the Nurofen Plus, trying to get my body to a point where just Nurofen works, which is a bit like going back to Freeview after experiencing Sky. And that's an experience I'm falling back on to help me get through the inferior painkillers. My week had started with a literary rejection that, and you know, I was pleased about this, a rejection that failed to push me into the default response jaw clench of mine. I've always maintained as a writer that the key to being a writer is to bounce back from the bad days that you have as a writer. And those rejections, you know, don't let them get you down. You've just got to brush them off and carry on doing what you believe in. Like any writer, I've had loads of rejections, but I've had the success too, and it's important for me to remember that. And it's weird because you will always have more rejections than successes in this line of work. But 17 rejections can be dismissed when you have that one success. It just needs one yes. You have to keep telling yourself that. 2009, when the BBC rejected my last big show early on in that year, I remember I was on a train from Putney, where I was living. I think I actually stayed on a stop longer that day because, being something of an amateur dermatologist, someone had got on with a skin condition which had particularly piqued my interest, and I was just staring at this. I was captivated by this, and it was ichthyosis, the condition, something I'm very familiar with now, having Googled the hell out of every dermatological condition over the last 7-8 years. So I was on the train when the call came from my old producer that the BBC had rejected what was my last big show. And I was taking that info on board, feeling very down about it. But I knew, I had this deep conviction that this was a Channel 4 piece that I was writing, that it was not a BBC show. And I told my producer that on the phone. And by the summer, Channel 4 had come in for the script. I'd signed the deal. As you get older, that self-belief might be harder to access, I suppose. Be lying if I said it wasn't, but it's still there. It's just harder to access now. You just wish as a writer that there was some way of knowing when a communication from an agent was on its way into your inbox. Look, David, there's some bad news on the way. You'd best smarten up. Something like that, just so you can be better dressed when that email arrives. For instance, I read that rejection at the start of the week in my 2011 Primark indoor-only fleece. If I'd known the email was on its way, I'd have worn a more recent item of clothing. So the way that would work is the rejection comes all the same, but you're better dressed at that moment, which makes bouncing back from the moment feel like it's not going to be so difficult, if you follow what I'm saying. In my case, last Monday, I was reading that email in that Primark indoor only 2011 fleece, navy blue, if you're asking. And it made the blow feel greater than it was. You know, I read that kind of email in the fleece and it feels like I'll be lucky to turn things around within 10 years. I think what would separate me from all agents if I was a literary agent is that I would send an initial email to writers, giving them fair warning that an email was on its way, which they would do well to read in their best clothes. And I think that's the kind of thinking that has to count for something in this world, surely. And I was having a month-old Golden Delicious at the time, the kind of rough apple that saw me abandon Ocado deliveries in the late noughties, actually. When delivery drivers are picking your fruit and veg, I think that's where the home delivery fails. You know, when I'm living out my final years, if I'm not in the care home, if I'm able to live a bit more comfortably and employ some care worker to come in and maybe sleep over, I don't mind getting the Ocado deliveries then. You know, fruit and veg isn't going to be a massive priority then. But in the late noughties, I still felt that I would live forever. I wanted the fruit to be perfect. Funny how things change within 7 or 8 years. The worst thing about being a writer is you hit every cliche in the book. The annoying thing is these days, with that next generation of literary agents that you're having to deal with, you desperately hope that the rejection doesn't come with an emoji or whatever it is they're called these days. I'll tell you something actually that bothered me more than that rejection though. Normally, I would see a tweet like this and it wouldn't matter, but it was, you know, it was a close friend. And I was just absolutely shocked when I read this tweet. Thursday, 2nd of February, approximately 14:03 hours. Mickey Boyd tweeting O2 Music. How do we go about getting our refund for the Drake concert last night? I've known this guy for 34 years. I watched his back-to-back sprint triumphs in the school sports day in the mid-80s. I was the ghostwriter for his London Lad column in our Mick and Dan on the Board School magazine of the late 80s. I put up with that guy taunting me the day after Arsenal beat Liverpool 2-1 in the 1987 Littlewoods Cup final. I watched Mickey Boyd's rise from centre-half to prolific school centre-forward, documenting his exploits in Mick and Dan. I endured 2 years of podcasting with him, 2 years of frustration watching flashes of his audio genius undermined by the notorious Please Don't Hug Me episode 22, bizarrely the most downloaded episode in our two-year hit-and-miss odyssey. I stood by and I watched this man wear a body warmer in his early 40s, even in the winter. I did all of that. Brexit, Trump, the night manager, I put up with all of that over the last year. But this man, a man with a 44-inch chest, a man born in the early 70s, a man older than me, going to a Drake concert. It's too much. I felt like I no longer knew him. Drake, he's older than me, really? I turned to the kid for help in trying to understand this because the kid himself had made the Drake concert at the start of the week. And my impression is that Mickey's Drake concert was cancelled, which is why he was tweeting O2. The kid emailed me back, is Mickey suddenly under 30 and into soft rap stroke hip hop music? I tweeted Mickey, who I know is passionate about his music. I tweeted in that for me, this was comparable with Harrison Ford getting his ear pierced in his early 60s. I was just shocked, you know, and the man can have his right to reply on next week's show. I've told him that the invite is there. He can help me understand this. I don't know, if I'm honest, if I want to understand. I don't know if this is something that could be understood, but he can have the right to reply. And, you know, let's be fair to this guy too. It should be noted that in the last 5 days alone, Mickey has donated both to this podcast and to Nelly's Get Neil Walking page. Underneath that big grain hirsute chest, there lies a heart every bit as wide as the width of his gaping jaw when he's plating. He is a good man. Hang on a sec, David. That doesn't justify going to a Drake gig. The man was born in 1971. He's got no business being anywhere near a Drake gig. All you're doing is what that colleague had told you had no business wearing that sleeveless hoodie in the summer of 07 did with you. That's true. Doing him a favour, David. It's a disgrace. He's grown out the wide band of hair on the temples too after looking so good with a shaven skull for a number of years. You don't need to bring up the wide band of hair. He doesn't like that. Hear me out, David. You're Drake, you see this white guy with a wide band of hair on the temples in his 40s. Is that the kind of audience you're aiming for? Isn't that going to affect your performance on the night? Moving on from lifelong middle-aged friends attending, or trying to attend as it turned out, hip-hop concerts. Healing now enough thankfully, to be able to venture out 2 days this last week, which means I can take you back to the cafe for our first visit to South Lambeth Road of 2017. The Londonist recently did a piece on one of the cafes in the area on Wilcox Close, which I occasionally go to on a Sunday night. I was there at the weekend, as a matter of fact, the weekend before this weekend just gone. And the piece did that cliched journalist thing of labelling it Little Portugal. I've got to say, I've never heard anyone, not even Portuguese people, call the area Little Portugal in nearly 30 years of haunting that road. It's a white middle-class label, it's a media label, which is why I never RT'd what was otherwise a good piece. It's just something that annoys me. It's up there with people calling Clapham Junction Clapham when it's not. I wish they wouldn't do that. So I was back in the cafe, easing myself in, disappointed that my early December surgery had come just a few weeks after discovering the cafe had a reward card scheme in place, which they had kept from me, because I suspect they know just how many free lattes someone like me will hit them for, which I already have. It's been difficult readjusting to being back out on the streets, feeling rusty, struggling with the adjustment of the winter coat fur. I'd gotten on top of it by early December, the excessive fur on the hood of my new winter coat. But the last couple of months I've obviously fallen out of practice. I was having hood-related issues once more on my way to the cafe. Wednesday, 1st of February, 11:42 hours. A man, not a regular, sat at his table over to my left, 2 rows up from my toilet table, which I was back at. And this man had ordered himself a custard tart. He paid there and then. Phil Collins, the little waitress who for over a decade was kitchen staff before stepping out front to cover for the alien owner after she got sick. Like Phil Collins stepping out from behind the drum kit after Peter Gabriel left Genesis, like that. Phil Collins returned the man's change as the man was handling his pastel de nata. This horrific hygiene fail happened because the man was not a regular. Had he been a regular, he'd have known that you pay at the end and he could have had a free from money handling custard tart. In terms of personality growth, as well as reminding me of Phil Collins in terms of the way she stepped out of the shadows to become a cafe frontman, the waitress, for me, also carries echoes of Cranberries singer Dolores. Was it Dolores O'Riordan? The name? I think the first name was definitely Dolores. When the Cranberries became massive overnight in 94, she was so shy. She was like me doing stand-up, no eye contact with the audience. And then as time went on, she got more confident. The eye contact improved. The Cranberries became massive. And with that, her confidence became very big. And she's a bit like that, Phil Collins. She's painting her fingernails too these days, blue. And for me, it's been interesting to watch this very slow evolution. She's never going to be a natural with people, the same way I'm not going to be a natural with people, but she has improved hugely. The coffee was poor upon my return on Wednesday. It would seem it doesn't take too long, despite my 16 years there, to become yesterday's poorly tipping customer in the cafe. The coffee was too dark. Only Seb K, the latte magician with a seborrheic keratosis lesion on the left temple, remembers how I like my coffee. Unless it's an espresso, which for me are usually no-go, given how hyper and anxiety-ridden I already am. I don't like dark coffee. I suppose I could have made something of a statement that day by asking for warm milk on the side, but while I'm still not there on a regular basis, it's pointless because they'd only forget by the time I return 5 mornings a week. If it's still going on when I'm, you know, back in there full time, then I'll pull them up on it, given that little reminder. 12:31 hours, Caesar Love arrived. I had my head down. I was working away on the second draft of the script. I think Caesar Love saw me. His Magister 1990 permed hair was cut shorter. He took the four-seater centre table, normally the preserve of future me. His back turned to me. Then he got up. He put his long dark coat on the back of the chair. Much of it left on the floor, I should say. All the while skillfully keeping his back turned to me as he put his coat on the back of the chair, which enabled him to skillfully avoid giving me the hello, which is someone who spent much of their life avoiding the hello and ensuing small talk I really did admire. As Caesar Love left, he dropped his pen, and I think he knew that he dropped it. I kept my eyes down to give him the opportunity to collect the pen. He failed to take that opportunity. He wanted to leave without greeting me at all costs. If he had to lose the pen to pull that off, then so be it. Phil Collins saw the pen. It had fallen a little distance from the four-seater Seeds had occupied. She asked the table in front of me if it was theirs. Seeds of Love was still at the bar. He was paying for his late breakfast. But he ended up leaving without the pen. He could probably hear the waitress behind him asking various tables if the pen was theirs. But he, you know, to have claimed it would have meant that he had to turn and face in my direction, and then he would have had to give me the hello. He ended up leaving without the pen, which, given he has numerous properties, I'm assuming the pen is with him, so he might be able to keep a note of which of his numerous tenants might have fallen behind on their rent. It was good to be back. Only the bouffant gave the regulars any indication something might be wrong with me. Disappointing moment right at the end when I claimed my free coffee with the reward card. Phil Collins never gave me my next reward card. Even the little volatile inked up waiter, heavily decorated, winning South London's most short-tempered waiter award from 2006 to 2010 and from 2012 to 2014, gives me a new card automatically. I had to help myself to it. And that is it. That is this week's show. That is the first trip of 2017 to South Lambeth's Finest Cafe. The finest cafe in London, I would argue, though I don't think I've given the cafe a very good review, let's say, upon my return this week. Before I go, let me plug the things that keep this podcast alive in the online world. Do please remember, this is an independent podcast. The simplest way to support the show is to do your Amazon shopping via the Amazon link at danielruistyson.com. You simply click on that link. It takes you through to Amazon as normal. And Amazon recognizes you've come via the referral link on my site and kicks back a small percentage of whatever you're buying on there at no extra cost back to my website. You can also, or instead of the Amazon option, make a donation. Always appreciated. Again, everything comes right back into this work covering bandwidth, for instance. You just click on the PayPal link at danielruistyson.com to make a secure donation. Either of those options keep this work going. Thank you. And if you're RTing links on Twitter for the show, if you're sharing on Facebook, it's all appreciated. And you know, if you like the show, why not let your friends know about it? Meantime, hope you guys enjoy the rest of your week and do what you do well. You can only do your best. Stay humble, stay grounded. Be mindful of those who might need help or a bit of company. That lonely elderly relative, for instance, you know, call them, visit them. Imagine yourself at their age. Don't be relying on this show to keep you company. I'll probably only have the energy to do 10-minute episodes by the time I'm in the care home. Actually, I am concerned on that front, I should say. Concerned that I've got no one coming up behind me. I am completely disconnected from the next generation of Ruizes. Not one of them will be helping me out if I make it into old age. That's definitely a concern, and it's definitely a certainty too. Shoulders back, people. Keep on walking towards the sun. I'm back next Monday. I'm Daniel Ruiz Tyson, and this week I have been available.